avec la rive sur la la dans les mauvais. On va quand on va être les Montréal les Maradio, c'est qui en mi Maradio.
Test. This is Dave Crippen, and with another interview in our Design History series. Today we're at American Motors headquarters on Plymouth Road, the old Nash Kelvinator building, as I recall. And we're interviewing the Richard A. Teague, well-known designer in the automotive industry, currently vice president for design. And we'll let Mr. Teague tell his story in his narrative in his own way.
Okay, thank you, Dave, for those glowing remarks. I guess if you're going to start anything, you probably ought to start at the beginning, and I can just kind of comment here on my life, which has been an interesting one, I guess. I was born in Los Angeles, California, and the day after Christmas in 1923. So that makes me 61 years old at this taping. This being the 22nd, I guess, of January, 23rd. And I grew up in Los Angeles up until the time I was about 5 years old, I guess, or six. My mother was an artist, my dad was an engineer. My aunt was also an artist. In fact, she was known as Hilda of Hollywood, the artist of the stars. I remember it like it was yesterday, because she was a very, very interesting character and a very good artist, by the way. And she used to paint portraits of all of the stars of the day. In fact, she went with a number of the stars, Walter Pidgeon for one, who just passed on, I think, just a few months ago. But in any event, when I lived out in Los Angeles, because my aunt was so closely associated with the movie industry, this year would be about 1928 or 9. I was born in 23, so it had to be about that period. My aunt, along with the efforts of my mother — this is straying a bit from the automotive end of it, Dave, but I might as well fill in all the slots here while we're talking.
Yes.
But anyway, through the efforts of both my aunt Hilda and my mother, I was in a couple of movies out there. The movies were sponsored by a fellow who was a contemporary of Max Sennett, although he by no means was as well known, nor was he as successful as Max Sennett. But he, in those days, in the Roaring Twenties, as they're called today, I guess a lot of smaller companies were trying to break into the movie industry if they had a large barn available and some would-be actors or hopeful actors, or whether they be children or adults, they would gin up a story of some type, usually a pretty weak storyline, and with some cameramen they would go out and try to break into the movie business. And the fellow that I was involved with through my aunt was a fellow by the name of Stan DeLay, and I don't know whatever happened to him, because bear in mind I was like 5 years old at the time. In fact, I was four when this thing started. And anyway, through the efforts of Mr. DeLay in acquiring a number of budding actors or actresses, little ones, children at the time, they made a number of movies, none of which were very successful, and they were all silence. In those days, there was no soundtrack in the film. And there were about, I guess, 12 or 13 kids in this particular group, and of course it was kind of inspired by the success of the Our Gang comedy series with Smokey McFarland and a lot of others that were very popular at that time. And these kid movies were very, very much sought after, and a lot of people getting into the act. And I was just part of one of those small groups. I was not by any means a successful child actor. A lot of rumors have a way of growing up, and they're very flattering, but not really that true. I was only in four movies, name of which I can only remember. I can remember two of the titles. And I'm coming up for retirement here in about a month. And I know that some of the people that are putting the retirement party together have tried very hard, and my wife's tried very hard to get a film of any one of those movies. And as I say, there's not much to go on. There's only two of them that I can remember the titles of. One was Kids, Cats, and Cops, all spelled with K's. And the other one was Crazy Days, D-A-Z-E. And they were put out by Stan DeLay, and they can't even find a record of him. The movie industry have been notorious, by the way, as a sidelight here, of keeping track of what they have done, particularly in the 20s and the 30s, and it wasn't until quite recently that there's been any kind of an effort at all to make a movie museum. There is one now, but it isn't all that great. But in any event, that's all lost to history now, but it's kind of an interesting little sidelight in my career, I guess. But I used to be pretty good, I guess, so I'm told by my mother, or was told by her before she died, that I was had a great memory. That's lapsed in recent years. I'm not that good, as you'll find out as the interview rolls on here. But I did have a very excellent memory, I guess, as a child, and I was kind of a precocious brat, I'm sure. I was an only child, except for my brother, who's a half-brother. And after my dad divorced my mother very early in the game, he married another gal, and of course I have a half-brothers as all of that, who lives out in California. But anyway, I was in several movies, and I've got a lot of early stills and so forth, which I kind of blanch at when I look at them. And it must be really tough for actors that were very popular, Betty Davis and a lot of the others that can see themselves on the screen, which I've never been able to do in recent years, to see their lives kind of unfold and that kind of a, see them deteriorate, I guess is the word. That must be very very heart-rendering for some of those actors that were handsome and young at the time and grew old and ugly. But
you may have seen the feature just recently. Dickie Moore has authored a book of reminiscences, edited a book of reminiscences of former child stars.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, I wish I could reminisce a little bit more, but I can't. The only two things I remember, Dave, about that experience, I was very young, bear in mind, you know, it's very difficult to remember things that happened almost 60 years ago now. But the only two things I remember, one, that I didn't like it at all. Number two, that the lights were very, very hot and difficult to see into. And so these were silence, and of course I was just coming up for a speaking part, and it was really right on the cusp of, I guess, being launched into a career that who knows how successful it might have been. But in any event, I did have a speaking part. Al Jolson had come out with a jazz singer, which I guess goes down in history as the first sound movie that had come to pass. And this was in 1928 or 29, I can't remember, of course. But anyway, I had this part that I was studying for and so forth, and I don't really remember very much about it. But on the corner of Wilshire Boulevard and Santa Monica Boulevard, they come together out in Beverly Hills, and I was in the front seat of my mother's 1925 or 6 Star two-door sedan, and some character, she stopped for the signal at that intersection, and somebody smashed into the back of us, and she smashed into the car in front, and these were plate glass windows in that car, and I went through the window and knocked out most of my baby teeth and broke my nose and received an eye injury that proved to be rather serious because I had to take my eye out. And this all happened on Christmas Day. When I was very young, I had a kind of an unfortunate situation that every Christmas we used to kind of really get rather antsy because something would happen the day after, or the year after. As a matter of fact, I lost my eye, which was on my 6th birthday. My father was in an automobile accident on Christmas Day, died 3 days later, and he was T-boned at an intersection down in Long Beach by a drunk who was celebrating. And he lasted about 3 days with a punctured lung and a fractured skull and other things. But in any event, that was around Christmas time. And then there were a whole series of things for about 3 or 4 years in there. I almost died when I was 8 years old and at Christmas with bronchial pneumonia. And I don't know, I guess God has a way of programming everybody's life for sure. And I guess for some reason or other he felt that I ought to survive, but I came very close not to surviving many, many, many times. In fact, it was so bad that my mother used to call me the Calamity Kid. When I was in the movies, that brief stint for about a year and a half there, everybody has to have another name, I guess, and I guess Dick Teague wouldn't have been glamorous enough, so my mother came up with a name called Dixie Duval, and I still have a couple of central casting directories which have Dixie Duval in it, and I bring those in once in a while to show the guys I have in the past, not to show me, because I'm in the back of it certainly, but to show some of the old stars that were very popular that day. These central casting directories, by the way, were used as they were used by the casting directors, and they would thumb through these things. They would come out every like 6 months or whatever, and the casting directors were obviously very important as far as selecting the characters for the forthcoming movie, whatever that movie would be, would thumb through this thing, and therefore they're looking for a heavy, and they're called heavies in this thing. It's kind of interesting, Davey. I can see them sometime, I'm sure. They've got to be kind of valuable, by the way. These two crazy books are invaluable to me, but to somebody, you know, the movie buffs and stuff that are interested in that sort of thing. All of the actors of the day were in there. Roscoe Carnes and Lewis Stone and Ned Sparks and, oh, God, Jimmy Finlayson and Eugene Pallette and just, you know, name it. They're all in there.
I'm an old film buff, so
are you? So you know what that is. Yes. Good. Well, I'll see as you see these, Dave. The next time we get together, maybe I'll bring them in. Just tell me, and and I've got some of these stills that the gang group, including a dog. They have to have a dog and a little black kid and the girl with I had a buckwheat and the gal with the funny old curls, which you know, Shirley Temple later made famous.
Darla,
Darla types. That's right. Yeah, you're obviously in with that.
Yeah.
Did you, by any chance, know if we can digress for a minute here, just for a minute? Did you know Tom Clancy?
Yes.
Yeah.
Only by telephone. He used to call me.
Yeah. Well, he's in bad shape now, but he's still around. But he's a vegetable. It's unfortunate. But he was the reason I mentioned his name. He really was into old movies and all of the stuff that went with and all of the details. And God, he was a walking dictionary. He really was. He'd name a movie and he'd tell you everybody, including the director, that, you know, one of those guys. But it's unfortunate that he's...
I'm sorry.
Yeah, it is. He was a great guy and a good friend. But anyway.
Great historian.
Yes, yes, he was. He was a historian on many, many subjects. Aircraft, too. He was pretty good on that. But we used to have a good time talking at some of the shows and the press reviews and so forth. But I just mentioned that movie thing because it has been brought up a number of times, and I just want to go on record to say that, you know, A, I don't remember very, very much about it at all. Number two, I was not a big star with the lights and the name on the marquee, none of that stuff. It was just a little brief, very small segment of my interesting life. But about that time, after I lost my eye, I wore a prosthesis, I still do. Someday maybe I'll wear a patch and a cape and a beret or something. I doubt that, unless I really go over the edge. But
obviously it hasn't deterred you from...
It never bothered me. My mother was a fantastic person, and you know, the longer you live, the more you appreciate those who brought you up. And she brought me up, you know, kind of solo because my dad was killed, and they were divorced anyway, but at least I used to see him a couple of times. She never made me feel sorry for myself at all, which is a thing that can happen. I have a brother-in-law he's gone now because he died very young, but he was born without an arm, and my mother-in-law babied him to the point and made him feel sorry for himself, and it really ruined his life. It really did. But my mother was smart enough to, she's a very intelligent woman in addition to being a very talented gal. She was a writer too, by the way, Dave. She was one of the first women that ever was a writer for the... both my parents were from Maine, Portland, Maine, and she was, God, I'm afraid if she was around today, she'd be a, you know, a woman's lib, you know, enthusiast, because she'd never take no for an answer as far as taking, you know, second place to male writers or whatever. But anyway, she got a job as a reporter for the, I don't know, the Portland Express or whatever it was. I really don't remember the name of it, but I've got a lot of, in fact, I was just looking at them the other day because we're packing up a lot of stuff to move back to California. And there's a lot of her writings in there. She used to write plays, and of course she was involved in that, and that's how she and Hilda, my aunt, got me kind of involved in movies, because she wanted to be a screenwriter and did some of that, as a matter of fact. And so she knew that all those characters that I can remember, Leroy Prinz, you probably, well, you wouldn't know of him, but
right.
I used to make model airplanes later after I lost my eye. I got, you know, tremendously interested in making models of everything, cars, of course. But I think really up until the time I learned to drive, I think if somebody were to ask me when I was 14 or 15, I got a driver's license early on a supposed necessity of being able to take my mother, who was crippled at that time, back and forth. So it really wasn't too much of a stretching of the truth. But in any event, I did have a driver's license very early. I think I was just under 15. And anyway, she, being a writer, she was very involved with the movie set. And after I lost my eye, and I was always enormous, I could get interested in anything. I guess I got a mind like that, what, for whatever that is worth. It's a, that and 50 cents or 75, I guess these days I'll buy a cup of coffee. But anyway, I got interested, very interested in airplanes and cars to a degree, but a lesser degree on cars, oddly enough, when I was young. I'm talking about, I was like 8 or 9 or 10 years old. And I used to build all kinds of model airplanes, and this guy, Leroy Prinz, was a good friend of my aunt. In fact, I think she'd painted his portrait. She painted Gene Harlow's portrait, and, oh, God, who was the, Leo Carrillo, and Walter Pigeon, of course, and, oh, God, she'd done, you know, portraits of all of stars. You just do them in a strange technique, which is long since dead. The technique was painting on velvet.
Oh,
that was all a rage in the 20s. And she used to paint what they called wall hangings, and I haven't heard that term since. I've got a couple that my aunt painted and my mother painted, and they're really pretty awful. They're always vertical in format, or mostly, not always, but mostly vertical, and they were scenes of, portraits, and it was this main thing that my aunt concentrated on. But they used to paint in oils on velvet, and then you'd put these rings through the top of them and slip a piece of wrought iron across with the arrowheads on the end, and they'd hang them on the wall. God, it makes me just about die today. Cringe to think about hanging one of those things anywhere. But in any event, because my aunt and my mother were so involved in that thing, my mother in writing and painting, and my aunt with painting, I used to really, you know, it doesn't mean, it was kind of natural, I never even thought very much about it, but I used to see a lot of these stars at that time, and Leroy Prinz was one of them. Well, he supposedly was, I don't know how much of an ace he was, but in the First World War, he was joined, I think, the Lafayette Escadrille, or one of the units that went overseas flying airplanes, and supposedly he was a World War I flying ace. Well, that was big to me, because I was so involved with Spads and Newports and 487s and triplanes and Sopwiths and all those others, that I used to build models of all these things. And anyway, my aunt, you know, kids today don't really realize what impact that depression, I'm talking about the big depression, this thing we had a few years back, was nothing. And I went through that whole thing, particularly without a father to take care of us. But anyway, that was so so devastating that you'd do anything to earn a few bucks. Well, my aunt got me mixed up with this guy, Leroy Prinz, and because he was a World War I ace, he called himself, and he was touted to be that, more PR, I think, than fact, but in any event, that happens. But nonetheless, he was a damn good dance director and did a lot of that for, I think, Paramount. He got interested in my abilities to make model airplanes, and I'll bet you I made him, I'm not kidding, Dave, I'll bet I made him 50, at least, balsa wood airplanes. Now, in those days, when you bought a kit, it was a few chunks of balsa wood hacked out with a bandsaw and a grubby set of plans and maybe something on the box that showed you something like the airplane looked like when it was in action. So I made these things, and I think they cost 10 cents, and they were made by the Bunch Company down on Vermont Avenue. I used to haunt that place because that's where I'd buy the kits. In fact, I got so interested in model airplanes that my mother, who was always trying to help me do whatever I wanted to do, she spoiled me to the gills, I guess, to a degree. But nonetheless, she never babied me, but she did, you know, she tried to get me within her very limited financial means get everything for me that it was possible to get. And she'd trade and swap paintings. God, I can remember that. She was the greatest trader in the world. I guess that's where I get some of my abilities to horse trade Ferraris and Pope Toledos and Packards and things like that. But in any event, I made all these models for Leroy Prince. And I know when I go over there to see him, it was kind of neat because here's this, you know, 10-year-old kid was coming through the front door at Paramount there and asking for Leroy Prinz, and God, the guy at the gate said, fine, Dixie, come on in, and I'd usually go over with Hilda, but anyway, or my mom, and we'd go in there and walk through the lot and got here, all these things going on, which I never paid very much attention to because it seemed, you know, I grew up with it, and it didn't seem very unusual, you know. In fact, one time they were making a movie, I remember it was called Zaza, and it was with Claudette Colbert. That'll probably ring a bell with you if you're a movie buff. And she was in the, well, when I showed up at the office with a couple of models to, and he'd give me, he was pretty generous, he really was. In those days, you know, it didn't seem like much now, but I think he'd give me $10 or $15 a piece for him, and my God, we could eat for a month on that, you know. It was go out and buy a soup bone, a bunch of soup vegetables, and boy, we were living high off the hog. But that depression was a rough, that was a rough deal, and kids today just, they think that's something that happened, you know, B.C. sometime. But I can remember that very, very, very well. And the you know, the people that were involved in that thing, and people being thrown out of their houses, and, you know, the sheriff coming, it happened to me and my mom. But anyway, so that was a little kind of a, I learned how to use my hands, and I used to like to draw, even as a kid. I used to get in all kinds of trouble, and this story has been much repeated by not me, but other people. Most designers got in trouble when they were kids in math class or history or social studies or something. That's the one I hated. But anyway, they really didn't, you know, most designers are, they're artists, you know, and they're a little bit different. That's the thing I'm going to miss, I guess, Dave, when I retire, because it's the electricity and the charisma and the personalities of all of the characters who are much different than engineering types, who are much more organized. I'd be the first one to admit it. Much more organized, but much more staid and much more conservative than designers are. You have to have that somehow in your makeup in order to make it happen, I guess, to some degree. But anyway, so anyway, I get by this time I'm 10 or 11, 12, somewhere in that range. And so I did an awful lot of model building, and then I got to, when I could gather enough money together, I learned about gas model airplanes, and that was really an interesting portion of my life. And I guess I started building gas model airplanes, free flights, you know, you just wind them up and with a Bunch engine or an Olsen 23 or a GHQ or whatever you had that you were able to afford. Usually the GHQ, that was a cheap engine, so you could, they were lousy though, you could never keep them running, never get them started, and they ran on spark plugs, not glow plugs like they use today. And I can remember the old auto-nips timers and stuff, so that in case you ever got the plane off the ground and it was going someplace, it would shut off before the gas tank, which was usually larger than it should have been, and the auto-nips timer would clip the wires in the car, the airplane would settle back to earth. But anyway, I don't know how many model airplanes I built, and every once in a while, if I needed some money, I'd build another airplane for Leroy Prinz. I'd go over there, and God, he'd stop everything, come in off the set, and, you know, he was really a charming guy. I remember that about him even as a kid, and he was a very busy guy, and yet he would take the time out to introduce me to Claudette Colbert one day when she was on the set there in this movie, and then, yeah, she I guess she's still living, isn't she?
Yes. Yeah. The Regans and the visited her a couple of years ago in Jamaica.
That's right. I do remember reading something about that. But she's, boy, she's got a lot of miles on her because, God, I was like 10 or 12 at that time. And and she, well, she was probably 22 or 3, probably. So she's
in her 80s.
Yeah, she's got to be. But anyway,
yeah,
she's well preserved. And I do remember she was just a charming lady. And she was in, I can even remember, you know, a lot of things I can't remember. You know, Alzheimer's a terrible disease. I don't have that. But anyway, oh, my God, I forgot the name of the memory course I took, I think. But anyway, she did have a black outfit on, and I was like about 12, you know, and I was just starting to realize there was another sex other than boys. You know, there were girls out there somewhere. And she came in this black outfit with a big which was part of the, she was a dancer. I don't remember the movie. I don't think I ever saw it.
Did you say it was Zaza?
Zaza, yeah. Yeah. And I do remember the name of the movie, and I remember she had this black outfit on, kind of skin tight, and she was rather sensuous-looking young lady at that time. But, so, anyway, that was my model airplane kind of a segment of my life, and then
obviously
I moved on to...
Obviously a good introduction to your later...
I guess, yeah. I don't know. As I said earlier, you know, the God works wondrous ways in everybody's life, and I guess that part is... I'm not all that spiritual, believe me, but I do believe in that sort of thing. But anyway, when I was introduced to gas model airplanes, and again, my mother was such a terrific person, and it's hard to remember all those years, but she used to, when she found out that I, by going down a Bunch's model airplane shop down on Vermont, that there was this new thing happening out there. Well, it was new to me, except these solid models or gliders or the wind-up jobs with the rubber band that would sometimes snap and take out the whole side of the fuselage and you're back to the drawing board or the building board. I realized that beyond that, there was this really sophisticated thing called gas model airplanes. And boy, when that really lit the fuse in my soul, because that was a whole new era that was opening up, and that really got me, but I couldn't afford it. So I finally gathered up enough money one time through some kind of I had a paper route and all this stuff. My mother was always trying to take care of me because she felt that I was, you know, having one eye, that I was going to lose the other one. And it very nearly happened a number of times, if I can bounce backwards for a minute. Right after I lost my eye, which was when I was 6 years old, as I mentioned, I used to like to play with boomerangs. I was, again, some aeronautic interest there. And I threw one day, and somebody spoke to me, and I turned around and then came back and hit me in the eye, in my good eye. And I used to wear a glass eye at that time. These days they're all plastic, of course. But anyway, I very nearly lost my eye with that one. I still have the scar in the sclera area of my eyeball. And then a dog bit me, and a cat scratched me, and, you know, I can remember, you know, days when I couldn't see anything because I'd have this patch over this one. Of course, I couldn't see out of the right one. And so I can, it must have, you know, looking back on it and having raised three kids myself and gone through all of their traumatic accidents and things of that type, I don't think I really can imagine the concern that my mother must have had as all these things happened to me, and her concern about that, because being an only child, I was her life, you know, and she was trying to keep both ends together by painting, and she used to give lessons to little kids and stuff. And I remember I didn't live in a house, Dave, until I was I guess it was after I came back here and got married. We always lived in the back of, when my mother was raising me, we lived in the back of a store. Mm-hmm. And that was pretty common practice, though, particularly during the Depression. Right. And you'd rent a store. Nobody owned anything. We didn't, at least. Mm-hmm. You'd rent this store, and she would put her paintings in the window, and then she'd put a sign up. I used to make the sign. So she taught me how to draw and make signs and things like that when I was very young. I used to be pretty good at that, but only because of her interest and as I say, I can get interested in anything, but I didn't really like making all these signs that say, you know, lessons 50 cents an hour. I remember that figure. And she'd have a class in there of 8 or 10 kids, and they never had any money either. And they'd well, we'll pay you next week, Thea. Her name was Dorothea, and she shortened it to Thea for her artist name, Thea Bradford. And that was her maiden name. But anyway, she used to encourage me in this new field that was opening up with this gas models. Boy, that was really something. I had gone the route of the solid models and the gliders and the wind-ups and the dual wind-ups with the twin booms and the Wakefield-type vehicles that we were all playing with at that time. And so I got a lot of... everything, I guess, you do in life kind of helps you in whatever you're going to be doing later on. And that taught me disciplines that, you know, that have lasted to this day. If you start something, finish it, and do the best job you can in between. Do your best and God will do the rest, somebody said. But anyway, I learned a lot by doing that. And in between all that, then I started kind of designing my own airplanes. I didn't know much about aeronautics, but, you know, for those things, it didn't matter too much. And that used to be a lot of fun. We'd, my friend Jack Linwood, who is still a very dear friend and a good friend, and a guy that lives out in California and teaches at Art Center. In fact, he teaches illustration at Art Center.
Really?
And he's an I'm not kidding. I'm not saying that because he's was my best friend growing up in my teenage years later, and also very early in the game. But he is probably the finest artist, all-around artist, that I've ever met, and then I've met a lot of guys. And he teaches illustration at Art Center, but he does all the covers, or did all the covers. I think he still does some for Ravel, for the Memphis Belle. You remember the B-17, the Memphis Belle? If you see that Ravel kit, well, he did the illustration. He does illustrations for all kinds of magazines, and he works with the movie industry out there for posters for Charlton Heston, that was in a movie not too long ago. It was a bummer of a movie. It's called Gray Lady Down, and it never got off the ground. I'm not so sure it ever even came into Detroit. I think it died on the cutting room floor, but he showed me the illustrations when I was out there. I see him about once or twice a year, and we have a great time talking about our model airplane building days. And Jack and I used to spend hours. I'll tell you, we didn't even though we knew that there were girls out there, we never really pursued it very much, because at that time airplanes were more fun. And so anyway,
less demanding.
Yeah, they didn't want you over there at 7 o'clock every night. So anyway, we would work literally, funds, you know, available. We would work literally 2, 3, or 4 o'clock in the morning, and then my very understanding mother, or his very understanding father, would take us out to Gotch Airport. Now, Gotch Airport, you never heard of, was out at 136 and Western. And that was the area where all the gas model freaks gathered on Sunday morning. That was the day. Don't ask me why Sunday morning, but you get out there at the dawn, they were flying these things. And so we'd go out there week after week, and my mother would usually, she was starting to get arthritis at that time, and I know it was a tremendous effort for her to get up and pull herself out of bed in the morning and gather Jack up, who lived just up the street. And she'd take Jack and I out to the airplane, and we'd have these airplanes ready to fly the next day, you know, with the Dawn Patrol, as we used to call it. And it was. And anyway, we'd build these model airplanes, and, you know, the first time you'd crank them up, if you didn't have the rudder set enough to correct for the torque, or you had a warp in the wing, or you had a whatever, you know, they were free flying. You had no control of them. When you launch them, go, sure, you'd hand launch them and glide them, and you know, if they'd turn to the left, well, you'd kick the left wing down a little bit so it'd keep it on a straight and narrow. But once you cranked up that engine with the torque turning to the left, you always had to compensate for that. I know when it's funny these things you remember, but when you hand launch one of these things on the field there, you know, just with the engine out, not running, and the prop had to be horizontal, of course, otherwise you'd break the prop, and that was 29 cents or something. Didn't want to do that. Anyway, they'd go straight, but you really wanted them to turn a little bit to the right, so you'd get a little more kick down in the left wing so that it would pull the aircraft or a little rudder, whatever. And I never could quite get that right, whether you ought to warp the wing down a little bit to turn right, or you ought to give a little bit of right rudder. And it really was kind of to me at that time at least, it was kind of a non-scientific way of doing a thing, it was kind of a trial and error thing. But the trial and error could be costly, because you'd lose the airplane if you didn't have enough of this in it, yet you wanted the aircraft to turn. So generally, it's a little bit combination of a little bit of rudder and a little bit of a kick down in the aileron area of the wing. They didn't have ailerons, they just warped the wings, and they were silk covered. And I know that was a lot of work to put those things together, but that was an interesting section of my life when I went through that. It must have lasted till I was about 15, anyway, 16. Even after I learned about girls, I'd still find time enough to work on those airplanes and do some drawing. And my mother used to encourage me, of course, she always wanted me to paint. Never really liked that very much. I may, you know, you go full circle, I guess, at times. But I never really really liked painting that much. I kind of like watercolors, but my mom was in oils and velvet, and I couldn't stand that stuff. God, it used to make me feel like two erasers, rubbing two erasers together, blackboard erasers.
Right.
Never liked velvet, but she loved it. And then she loved to paint on canvas, too, of course. And I never really liked canvas. I guess I was so close to it, and I'd see all these little runny-nosed kids that would come in on Saturday mornings at 50 cents an hour, and a half a dozen of those little monsters in there jumping and screaming and yelling and, you know, trying to get Thea's attention to come over and help her instead of the other one. And so that's when I'd go in the back room and close the door and do the model airplane thing, or pick up a sketch pad and start drawing something. But anyway, So that lasted, I guess, till I was really into airplanes, and I could never afford it. I know I was always broke, never had any money. I had a paper route to augment the thing, and then I worked at a place, even before I really had a license, I worked at a place called Carl's Drive-In, and had some interesting experiences there. But before I get into that, I might mention that when I lived on Western Avenue near Santa Barbara, that's when I met Linwood. And that's when I was starting to realize that this model airplane thing was out there, and it was gas model airplanes, and those things had motors in them and spark plugs, and all that all appealed to me because I was a kind of a mechanical kid a little bit. And so my mother, in order to make both ends meet, had a combination. This sounds bizarre as I relate it. It's kind of a crazy combination, but again, she was playing to my interests. Now, she would never let me have a bicycle because I had the one eye. She wouldn't let me have that. But for some reason or other, scooters didn't bother her. Scooters were okay. And I was probably the oldest kid that ever, you know, pushed a scooter around the block. Cause all the kids were on bicycles, and they used to laugh at me. I can remember that. But she felt that somehow when you were straddled over a bicycle, you know, that was dangerous. Don't ask me to explain the logic, but that's the way she really, really did feel. So, anyway, she got interested through a guy by the name of Floyd Clymer, who I'm sure you've heard of.
Yes.
Anyway, Floyd Clymer, I'm trying to remember now how in the hell she got to know him. I think she sold a painting to his wife or traded a painting. It was something involved with one of her paintings, because everything revolved around her paintings and me.
Mm-hmm.
And met Floyd Clymer. Well, he got her interested. He was selling, probably never heard about it, but you heard of Crocker Motorcycles. Well, the Crocker Company, and I can't remember now where the heck they were from, but they made, the motor scooters were starting to become very popular. There was no money in the 30s at all, just coming out of the Depression. In fact, we weren't out of it. And so she had a combination, anything to make a buck. My aunt used to say that if my mother had been a man, she would have been the head of General Motors. I can remember that statement, because she was really a bright woman. And she was a wheeler and dealer. So she got involved in not only her painting thing, which was Thea's Studio. She called it Thea's Studio. And for a while, we sold model airplane supplies. And it was a way, really, as I look back on it, that she could get these kits and these engines and these, all the balsa wood and the silk and all that other glue and all that junk. She could get that stuff wholesale. And so it was really kind of a front. Although we did sell quite a few toys. And in those days, you'd take things on consignment. Everybody's so damn broke that the model suppliers, the Bunch Company, which I keep mentioning, and there was Cleveland kits down here in Cleveland. And they, boy, when you got a Cleveland kit, that was the best one you could get. And there was Carl Goldberg out of Chicago that had a lot of stuff, Comet kits and stuff. But anyway, she got interested in that because of me and my interest in model airplanes. So she had this studio. She said, well, it was a door went through the middle, and there was a place on each side for putting up whatever you wanted to put up that you were selling. So one side, she put her paintings up on one side. And the other side, she would have this model airplane thing. And then we met, and I used to handle that on Saturdays. She'd only do that on Saturdays and Sundays when she was teaching the kids. Well, I'd be handling the shop there. I was like 14 years old or something at this time. But anyway, I got to know all the kids in the neighborhood, because I went to junior high school out there, of course. And it was just up the street. And I belonged to the model airplane club there, and I was really involved in that. And so somehow this connection between Clymer happened, and I really don't remember quite how that happened, but he and I got to be really good friends. He was a neat guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he was selling Crocker motor scooters. And boy, I wanted one of those things so bad, because, you know, model airplanes were okay, and the girls were off there. Well, that was interesting, too. But I guess I needed another hobby, or I wanted to get something with wheels on it, something that would be a little more self-contained, something that I could get on or in or do something with. And I knew I couldn't get a car quite that early. I was about 13, I guess, at the time. And so this motor scooter thing came into my life, and along with Floyd Clymer. And I knew him for years. After I moved back here, I used to correspond with him, and we'd go to dinner once in a while when I worked at GM later. But anyway, she took on not only the Crocker motor scooter dealership In those days, all you needed was the sign and a couple of order blanks, and they'd loan you a demonstrator. Okay, you needed nothing, no cash up front. Not only that, at one point in time, she had three of them. One was Motor Glide, a guy by the name of Hugh, and hell, his brother's name was, but the Salisbury brothers out on Manchester or Slauson. Anyway, they had a little factory, and they were in the motor scooter business. There was a time there when the motor scooters were, you know, like a hula hoop, not quite, but everybody was in the motor scooter business. It was a Spring Cycle, there was the Motor Glide, there was the Auto Glide, there was the Powell, but Motor Glide was kind of the Cadillac of, well, really the Crocker was a Cadillac because it was most expensive, and it was made by a motorcycle builder, not just a bunch of guys that decided to build a put Briggs and Stratton engines or whatever in with a couple of Musselman wheels and tires and a handlebar and a kickstarter and some handle grips, and you had a motor scooter. These guys were a lot more sophisticated than Crocker. So they were, when we had that Crocker sign there, that would bring in some people, and it was a little bit like the automobile business today. They'd come in to look at the Crocker, and they'd buy the Powell or the Motor Glide or the Serbi Cycle or whatever. So anyway, we had one each of these things. We could never afford to stock anything in there, although you could have had them on consignment. Once in a while, if the company was in trouble in 35 and 36 and 37, the company would, they'd bring it, not only loan you a demonstrator, but for 10% or something down, you could get, you know, one, some stock in the company, and you'd bring one in, and you'd have one to sell and let it go out the door. But anyway, I used to demonstrate these things. And for some reason or other, even with my vision problem, my mother never worried much about me being on a motor scooter. I guess it was going back to the fact that you weren't straddling it. You know, you could get knocked off easy enough, and you know, that took her problem away, and it helped mine because I was dying to drive these things all over the place. And I must have driven her nuts when I look back on it, because you know, I was always putting her on to, hey, I want to go over to see one of my girlfriends, or up to Linwood's, or Linwood and I were going to get two of us on the thing. It would have been double trouble, and we were going to go somewhere, and don't you know, I need a motor scooter, because then I can keep the paper route going, it's a lot easier. And so I used to wear the demonstrator. I really demonstrated the demonstrator. But
did you ride on the roads, or on the...
Oh, yeah, sure, yeah. Okay. They weren't very chicken about that in those days, you know. They, in the first place, they couldn't catch me anyway. I got chased a couple times. But you go up the alley, and the police cars, they got 36 Fords wallowing around trying to catch up with you. You could go out and, you know, go between houses and stuff with those things. So they never caught me, but I was chased a number of times. I must have been my mother used to call me a hellion. Now, there's an old phrase, you remember?
Oh, yeah.
Someday somebody's going to do a car called, maybe it'll be me, I'll do a car called a hellion. It's kind of a neat name.
Yeah.
Or it rolls off your tongue rather well. But she used to call me a hellion. She used to call me a gremlin, too. That's how I named the car Gremlin.
Oh, really?
I'm responsible for that, yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah, Dixie and his gremlins, she used to call me, and this cadre of friends that I used to have, but who were all involved in model airplanes, and God, today it's dope and all that stuff. It's too bad, but anyway, it's the way it is, I guess. But God, I was addicted to airplanes and motor scooters and cars, and almost anything that would run or I could make run was a fun thing to do. And so anyway, time went on, and we had this combination, it sounds bizarre, combination art shop and paintings and frames. Oh God, she sold frames too, and she sold art materials. She did pretty well with that. And I can remember going down to the DeVoe company, D-E-V-O-E, and they were downtown. That was a long ways away. It really wasn't, but it seemed like it. And anyway, we'd go down there, and she would sign up, you know. Accounts receivable must have gone crazy. But anyway, she would sign up, and she'd want DeVoe and Reynolds and Winsor Newtons and all these other painting, you know, oil materials, oil painting materials, tubes of paint, she called it. That's what it was called. And rolls of canvas and stretcher bars. And God, I used to probably put more stretcher bars together than I can ever remember. Hammer those things together and tack them and then stretch the canvas over. And, you know, I did all that. But anyway, so she had this combination. There's really about five functions in there. But she did all that stuff just to keep meat on the table, and not much of it at that. But anyway, she would back me on anything I wanted. If I liked motor scooters, well, she'd get a motor scooter dealership. Like model airplanes, she'd get a model airplane shop. And, you know, she was a fantastic person, and I really realize that now, so late in life. But anyway, So we had this combination art shop. Yeah, she sold all kinds of supplies, art supplies. And then on the other side was the motor scooter and model airplane shop. And I took care of that. That was a mechanical thing. I was about 13 or 14, 15 maybe, I don't know, the outside. And so we lived on Western Avenue in the back of this. We had this, naturally had the, you know, you lived in the back with the with a shower, as I recall, and a kitchen stove, which was always smoking and pain in the neck, those old things. And that was it. And I had my own little room there off to the side. I remember that we lived there longer than any other time. We couldn't pay the rent, we'd move on. And so that was all in the Leimert Park, Los Angeles area. It's now near Baldwin Hills and all that. So
how
I grew up.
How do you spell the park area?
Beg pardon?
How do you spell the park area? Leimert?
Leimert Park, yeah. And I went to Dorsey High School, Audubon Junior High and Fauché Junior High and Dorsey High School. And that's all within about a 5-mile radius around there. I grew up right in that segment of the world.
For the transcriber, can you spell Leimert and...
Leimert, L-E-I-M-E-R-T, I believe.
It was Leimert Park.
Leimert Park. And that was...
Audubon.
Audubon, A-U-D-U-V-O-N.
Right,
Audubon, Audubon, A-U-D-U-V-O-N, Audubon, Audubon, yay, yay, yay. I did a little cheerleading for a while out there, too. So, yeah. Like the Audubon Society is. But anyway, so every once in a while on a really, you know, if it was really something that would be kind of a special day, you know, Memorial Day or it wouldn't be 4th of July, but when I was going to school. But once in a while, my mother let me take the motor scooter to school, and that was a big deal. I've still got some pictures of that, standing around. Boy, I was really the king. I had a motor scooter. I was the other kid that had bicycles. I never had a bicycle in my life. She wouldn't allow that. But she let me take this motor glide. It was a motor glide, a Salisbury motor glide. And I got to know Hugh Salisbury really well, and I was such a character. I guess these guys had put up with me, and I liked mechanical things, and I was always pestering these guys to drive their new model and be the test pilot, stuff like that. I used to go to the factory over there. Was that on Manchester? Can't remember. But anyway, it was a few miles from where we had the shop there. And Hugh Salisbury was a very nice guy, and he was very understanding with my mother's financial condition, because everybody had a financial condition. It was minus something. And anyway, he would come over once in a while, come by to see the dealership. You know, Jesus, I'm sure he would blanch when he'd see it. It was a store with one side of it that was partial model airplanes and partial scooters. We had a scooter in the window, usually. And then a couple of the models that I'd made be hanging above it, and it was Thea's studio, she called it. Still called it studio. And so anyway, this Motor Glide, by the way, I still have some pamphlets of the thing. I just ran across them the other day. And Motor Glide was the one that Roscoe Turner, the famous aviator and winner of the Thompson Trophy race, I guess, in 36 or 5 or something, with his lion. You remember he had his lion?
Yeah,
yeah. Anyway, Roscoe Turner, I never met him, but I ran across the other day some one-sheet pamphlets that show Roscoe Turner and his fold-up motor glide they put it folded up, the handlebars would fold down, and you could pick the thing up. It was almost like some of the later parabikes that they had during the war. In fact, I'm sure they were inspired by that little bike. They'd strap them on their back and jump out of the airplane and, you know, go someplace when they got on the ground. But those were made in England with a different type of a mechanical, and they were even lighter than the motor glides, much lighter. But I always wanted to pick up one of those things. I may do that one of these days. Either a motor glide, which I've looked for years and have been unsuccessful in finding one, as much as I have had many antique and classic and sports cars, I've never run across a doggone motor glide. I'd like to get one just for nostalgic reasons, I guess. But anyway, so I used to take that to school once in a while. That was fun. And then I got clipped by a car one day. I'm sure it was my fault. And that dislocated my shoulder. And one portion of my life that I didn't mention, when I lived up in Topanga Canyon when I was much younger in my movie, or ex-movie, after movie days, I broke my left arm because I used to like to walk from up in the mountains in Topanga Canyon down to, right down to the beach, it seemed like a long time, I mean a long ways at that time, but it really wasn't that far. I've driven up there a few times later years, of course, and it's probably maybe a total of 4 miles or so. But anyway, it seemed like a long way. But I fell off a wrist or a cliff one day and broke my arm, and that was the first thing that happened to me after I went through the windshield. That was another reason my mother used to call me the Calamity Kid, because there was a series of things in there, Dave. I'll tell you, in about 4 years' time, when it just must have driven my mother right up the wall, because I had all kinds of things. And happened to me, and that was one of them. Broke the radius in the ulna, and I know I came. It didn't hurt. I can remember this to this day. It never hurt very much. And I knocked it under when I landed. I was walking down the creek bed, and I slid off this rock into there was a little puddle down there, and I thought I was going to just jump down to that to save walking around the rock. So anyway, it didn't work out, and I broke my wrist, and I came home. I can remember my mother bursting into tears when she saw my hand laying there, you know, back parallel with my arm. But that was another reason that got me the Calamity Kid name, at least her name for me. But anyway, back to the teenager kind of a thing. My mother at that time started to have arthritis bother her a great deal, and she could still operate and get around, but not real well. You could see she was getting older. Well, she wasn't really old looking back on it now, as I'm old. But anyway, she was not as active as she was, even just a few years. It seemed like it happened very quick, as I recall it. But anyway, she didn't like to drive that much. The traffic bothered her. Well, she was a good driver. And she made an arrangement to give me a special license so that I could drive. And I'm sure, looking back on it now, you know, after all these years, she probably did that because she knew I wanted a car and I wanted to drive. So she was trying to patronize me, I guess, or whatever. Spoil me, if you will. And we didn't have any money for a car. She had a car, but certainly not enough for a second one. And, of course, I wanted a car of my own. This time I was about 15. So Linwood, my model airplane building friend and the world's greatest artist living today, in my view, and I, without either my mother's consent or his parents' consent, went out and bought, it was our first car. It was a 1925 four-cylinder Chevrolet four-door sedan. That's got to be, if you looked up the word ugly in the dictionary, you'd see a picture of that. So anyway, we bought that car for $5, and I had $250 and he had $250. And unbeknownst to our parents, we really used that car. I don't know where we got the gas, probably siphoned it, and I was big on that. Oh, that was the only thing to do. You didn't have the money, so you'd get the rubber hose and you'd find a neighbor that had some gas in the tank and you'd siphon out. So that wasn't really a problem.
Realize how dangerous it was.
No, that's right. And nor did you care. You know, well, the heck is dangerous, but you got to go to see the girl or whatever, you know. So Linwood and I, that was our car. We used to rattle around in that thing, and then we'd go over to see our buddies that were also building model airplanes, a guy named Dick Sykes, I remember that. He later became a general in the Air Force. But anyway, he was a model airplane nut. So we had this cadre of friends. Larry Clapp. Strange name, but that was his name. He was a very good model builder. We used to go see him. Then we go see Frank Bertinelli and a bunch of other guys. And then this having this automobile and this freedom to go somewhere must have been about like the burgeoning years of the automobile industry, when, you know, it was, you were suddenly unshackled from your small world and you were allowed to go to long distance places or things that you dreamed about. So we used to drive over to North Hollywood to see one of my girlfriends, and then we'd go over to North Long Beach. Linwood had a girl over there, and of course she'd always have a girl, so we doubled it. We were like 15 or 16. 15, I guess. That's before I got the license. My mother didn't know about this, and she found out, and then she was really bent out of shape. So we had to sell a car. We sold it. But anyway, that was the first car that I ever owned, and I was a co-owner with Linwood on that one. But we had a lot of fun with that thing. And all the while we were furiously, you know, getting ready for the Sunday, which was the big day when either his parents or usually my mother would take us out to Gotch Airport, and we'd fly these things that we'd build all week and wreck them in the first 15 minutes usually. But anyway, I'm trying to get over a cold so I don't know how long my voice is going to last. Hope it will last for a while. But, yeah, let's see. When I got this car, I wanted this car. I wanted a real car. The 25 Chevy was okay, but, you know, and once I was found out about this thing and my mother was mad and Linwood's parents were mad, got rid of the car. Didn't have any insurance. My God, if we'd ever hit anything, it would have been, you know, Disastersville. But we never did. We didn't, you know, wouldn't go fast enough to drive very recklessly anyway. Just driving it was being reckless, I guess. But one day, my mother was going up Wilshire Boulevard. I can remember this like it was yesterday. And I was alongside her in this Dodge, I think she had at the time, or Plymouth. She was big on Chrysler products then. And old Chrysler products. She never had a car that was newer than 6 or 7 years old. Even the Star that I got clipped in was might not even been a 25, I was 23 or 4. But, and that was in 1929, I guess. But, so I was familiar with old cars, or not new cars at least. And, anyway, we were driving up Wilshire Boulevard, and it was at night, I remember. And she was going out to sell a painting, or trade a painting, or some cockamamie trade deal with somebody. And I'm looking out the window, and, geez, I spot right on the corner of Wilshire Boulevard and something. I can't remember the name of the street, according to me now, but anyway, there was a powder blue 1932 Ford three-window coupe. Had 16-inch wheels on it. It was powder blue. Had 16-inch wheels on it and ripple discs, as they were called in those days. You remember those, Dave? Mm-hmm. How old are you, by the way, Dave?
60.
Well, we're almost the same age. Right. I just turned 61, so you can, a lot of stuff I'm talking about you can relate to. So, anyway, here this beauty was sitting. It was night, the place was closed. And here was this 32 Ford sitting, you know, cameo position, right on the corner, right on the corner. We're going this way, and I said, God, Mom, look at that car. I said, geez, I was just starting high school then, so I had to be 15, 16. And I said, hey, you know, if I got that, then I could drive you around. You could sell the Dodge or the Plymouth or whatever we're in. Well, I don't know about that, but let's go back and look. So she turned around and went back and looked at that thing. Of course, they were closed. And on the window, it says special $125. Well, that was nothing, though. That was really, in fact, it was probably high because it was Beverly Hills. And it was Hillcrest Motors. They're still in business. In fact, the guy that owns it is a car nut. He probably wished he had the car back. Well, it was before him, although this guy's 85 years old or something. He's kind of a character. But Hillcrest Motors today have one of the finest vintage and classic and sports car collections in the West Coast. Not a lot of them. They got about 30 cars, but they're very, very good cars. But that was Hillcrest Motors, and they were Cadillac dealers. And they'd taken this thing in trade from somebody, I don't know. It was $125. The next day, she called up. And again, the old trade painting comes into the thing. So she traded about $50 of the price, had to come up with the other $75. I don't know how she did that, or how I did. I was working at that time, parking cars. And anyway, we came up with the money, and I bought the car. That was my first car. And I'll tell you, I was really king of the walk at Dorsey High School. I was in the 10th grade over there, and I had that car. And I want to tell you, boy, that really changed my life. I went from airplanes and girls to cars and girls, and that was a lot better. Mm-hmm. That was a lot better. Right. The girls were softer and the cars were faster, and I could relate to the cars. And so anyway, we. I had a lot of fun with that car. I never had an accident. You know, I was a lead footer too, and I got more tickets. And God, I remember I went to in that car because it was a. Well, the first thing I did once I got the car. In those days, what you do? Well, it was pretty well equipped. It had the 16-inch wheels and the Kelsey wheels underneath them, which were beautiful as you hid with the funny-looking ripple disc, mm-hmm. with a bar on it. You know that one? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, what you'd do in order to really be in with your peers and your friends and the guys that had the good cars, because, you know, Dorsey High School was not far from up in Leimert Park, and what's the other, there's kind of a snobby section up there where they had a lot of money, and those kids, they were driving, this is in 39, when I was in the 10th grade, about 39, and these kids were all driving 36, 37, 38 Fords. You know, they were only a year or two old, and they were rich kids to me. and because I didn't have any money at all. So anyway, I was still in with that 32 because boy, that was a neat looking little car. It was a 3-window, which is better looking than the 5-window, and it had a little latch. I remember back of the window, which would drop, by the way, and a little latch back there, and the back would flip open. You had a rumble seat, so you'd take your friends. Mm-hmm. And had the 16-inch wheels, had the wheel covers. I had a chrome dash in it. That's the thing that really got me. And somebody had gone all the trouble, probably going to a custom plating company out there and having the dash out and had it chrome plated. And boy, that was really, you had a chrome plated dash, a 32 Ford with 16-inch wheels. You couldn't do much more to that car, except you could hop it up. Mm-hmm. I didn't have anybody to hop it up. But
that was in. We were just beginning out there.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, it was pretty well along. Ed Eskandarian, who you may or may not have heard about, he had a big article in one of the magazines here a while back. Anyway, I didn't really switch my allegiance or my friends, my cadre of friends from airplanes to cars, because Linwood had also gotten a car a little bit before I had, because he's a couple of years older. And so he had a car first, and that was another big pitch is why I had to have a car, because Linwood had one. You know, those kids played that on me. My kids played that on me later. Well, you know, he's got one. How come I don't have one? You know, that how that works if you got kids.
Yeah.